Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I also post the links at pieville.net, our social medium, microblog, and at my Kirksville Today, where I do a white world wrap daily. We're going to resume today with more from Hector Human Rowe, The Complete Stories of Saki. We're about a third of the way through. We're in the Beast and Super Beast section, and we'll do four stories as usual. The first story is The Hen. The Hen. Dora Bitholtz is coming on Thursday, said Mrs. Sangrail. This next Thursday? Asked Clovis. His mother nodded. You've rather done it, haven't you? He chuckled. Jane Martlett has only been here 5 days, and she never stays less than a fortnight, even when she's asked definitely for a week. You'll never get her out of the house by Thursday. Why should I? Asked Mrs. Sangrail. She and Dora are good friends, aren't they? They used to be, as far as I remember. They used to be. That's what makes them all the more bitter now. Each feels that she has nursed a viper in her bosom. Nothing fans the flame of human resentment so much as the discovery that one's own bosom has been utilized as a snake sanatorium. But what has happened? Has someone been making mischief? Not exactly, said Clovis. A hen came between them. A hen? What hen? It was a bronze leghorn or some such exotic breed, and Dora sold it to Jane at a rather exotic price. They both go in for prize poultry, you know, and Jane thought she was going to get her money back in a large family of pedigree chickens. The bird turned out to be an abstainer from the egg habit, and I'm told that the letters which passed between the two women were a revelation as to how much invective could be got onto a sheet of notepaper. How ridiculous, said Mrs. Sangrail. Couldn't some of their friends compose the quarrel? Interesting suggestion. You wouldn't see people say it that way nowadays, but compose the quarrel, and you can tell what it means from the context. Couldn't some of their friends compose the quarrel? People tried, said Clovis, but it must have been rather like composing the storm music of the Fliegende Hollander, the Flying Dutchman. Jane was willing to take back some of her most libelous remarks. Fliegen is fly, like think Red Bull. It's also an opera. Jane was willing to take back some of her most libelous remarks if Dora would take back the hen, but Dora said that would be owning herself in the wrong, and you know she'd soon think of owning slum property in Whitechapel as do that. It's a most awkward situation, said Mrs. Sangrail. Do you suppose they won't speak to one another? On the contrary, the difficulty will be to get them to leave off. Their remarks on each other's conduct and character have hitherto been governed by the fact that only 4 ounces of plain speaking can be sent through the post for a penny. I can't put Dora off, said Mrs. Sangrail. I've already postponed her visit once, and nothing short of a miracle would make Jane leave before her self-allotted fortnight is over. Miracles are rather in my line, said Clovis. I don't pretend to be very hopeful in this case, but I'll do my best. And as we know, Clovis specializes in dirty tricks. As long as you don't drag me into it, stipulated his mother. Servants are a bit of a nuisance, muttered Clovis, as he sat in the smoking room after lunch, talking fitfully to Jane Martlett in the intervals of putting together the materials of a cocktail, which he had irreverently patented under the name of an Ella Wheeler Wilcox. I don't know, I would guess she might be a temperance type. It was partly compounded of old brandy and partly of curacao. That's the Dutch Antilles, or the Dutch island in the Caribbean, Curacao. Orange, Dutch orange. There were other ingredients besides the brandy and Curacao, but they were never indiscriminately revealed. Servant's a nuisance, exclaimed Jane, bounding into the topic with the exuberant plunge of a hunter when it leaves the high road and feels turf under its hoofs. I should think they were. The trouble I've had in getting suited this year, you would hardly believe. But I don't see what you have to complain of. Your mother is so wonderfully lucky in her servants. Sturridge, for instance, he's been with you for years. I'm sure he's a paragon, as butlers go. Paragon is a perfect model of something. That's just the trouble, said Clovis. It's when servants have been with you for years that they really become a serious nuisance. The here today and gone tomorrow sort don't matter. You've simply got to replace them. It's the stayers and the paragons that are the real worry. But if they give satisfaction, that doesn't prevent them from giving trouble. Now, you've mentioned Sturridge. It was Sturridge I was particularly thinking of when I made the observation about servants being a nuisance. The excellent Sturridge a nuisance? I can't believe it. I know he's excellent, and we just couldn't get along without him. He's the one reliable element in this rather haphazard household, but his very orderliness has had an effect on him. Have you ever considered what it must be like to go on unceasingly doing the correct thing in the correct manner in the same surroundings for the greater part of a lifetime? To know and ordain and superintend exactly what silver and glass and table linen shall be used, and set out on what occasions to have cellar and pantry and plate cupboard under a minutely devised and undeviating administration, to be noiseless, impalpable, omnipresent, and, as far as your own department is concerned, omniscient. I should go mad, said Jane with conviction. Exactly, said Clovis, thoughtfully, swallowing his completed Ella Wheeler Wilcox. But Sturridge hasn't gone mad, said Jane with a flutter of inquiry in her voice. On most points, he's thoroughly sane and reliable, said Clovis, but at times, he is subject to the most obstinate delusions, and on those occasions, he becomes not merely a nuisance, but a decided embarrassment. What sort of delusions? Unfortunately, they usually center around one of the guests of the house party, and that is where the awkwardness comes in. For instance, he took it into his head that Matilda Sheringham was the prophet Elijah, and as all that he remembered about Elijah's history was the episode of the ravens in the wilderness, he absolutely declined to interfere with what he imagined to be Matilda's private catering arrangements, wouldn't allow any tea to be sent up to her in the morning, and if he was waiting at table, he passed her over altogether in handling round the dishes. How very unpleasant. Whatever did you do about it? Oh, Matilda got fed after a fashion, but it was judged to behest for her to cut her visit short. It was really the only thing to be done, said Clovis with some emphasis. I shouldn't have done that, said Jane. I should have humored him in some way. I certainly shouldn't have gone away. Clovis frowned. It is not always wise to humor people when they get these ideas into their heads. There's no knowing to what lengths they may go if you encourage them. You don't mean to say he might be dangerous, do you? Asked Jane with some anxiety. One can never be certain, said Clovis. Now and then he gets some ideas about a guest which might take an unfortunate turn. That is precisely what is worrying me at the present moment. What, has he taken a fancy about someone here now? Asked Jane excitedly. How thrilling. Do tell me who it is. You, said Clovis briefly. Me? Clovis nodded. Who on earth does he think I am? Queen Anne, was the unexpected answer. Queen Anne? What an idea. But anyhow, there's nothing dangerous about her. She's such a colorless personality. What does posterity chiefly say about Queen Anne? Asked Clovis rather sternly. The only thing that I can remember about her, said Jane, is the saying, Queen Anne's dead. Exactly, said Clovis, staring at the glass that had held the Ella Wheeler Wilcox. Dead. Do you mean he texts me for the ghost of Queen Anne? Said Jane. Ghost? Dear no. No one ever heard of a ghost that came down to breakfast and ate kidneys and toast and honey with a healthy appetite. No, it's the fact of you being so very much alive and flourishing that perplexes and annoys him. All his life he has been accustomed to look on Queen Anne as the personification of everything that is dead and done with. As dead as Queen Anne, you know, quoting. And now he has to fill your glass at lunch and dinner and listen to your accounts of the gay time you had at the Dublin Horse Show, and naturally he feels that something's very wrong with you. But he wouldn't be downright hostile to me on that account, would he? Jane asked anxiously. I didn't get really alarmed about it till lunch today, said Clovis. I caught him glowering at you with a very sinister look and muttering, ought to be dead long ago, she ought, and someone should see to it. That's why I mentioned the matter to you. This is awful, said Jane. Your mother must be told about it at once. My mother mustn't hear a word about it, said Clovis earnestly. It would upset her dreadfully. She relies on Sturridge for everything. But he might kill me at any moment, protested Jane. Not at any moment. He's busy with the silver all the afternoon. You'll have to keep a sharp lookout all the time and be on your guard to frustrate any murderous attack, said Jane, adding in a tone of weak obstinacy. It's a dreadful situation to be in, with a mad butler dangling over you like the sword of what's-his-name, but I'm certainly not going to cut my visit short. Clovis swore horribly under his breath. The miracle was an obvious misfire. It was in the hall the next morning, after a late breakfast, that Clovis had his final inspiration as he stood engaged in coaxing rust spots from an old putter. "Where's Miss Marlett?" he asked the butler, who was at that moment crossing the hall. "Writing letters in the morning room, sir," said Sturridge, announcing a fact of which his questioner was already aware. "She wants to copy the inscription on that old basket-hilted saber," said Clovis, pointing to a venerable weapon hanging on the wall. "I wish you'd take it to her. My hands are all over oil." He's removing rust spots. "Take it without the sheath. It will be less trouble." The butler drew the blade, still keen and bright in its well-cared-for old age, and carried it into the morning room. There was a door near the writing table leading to a back stairway. Jane vanished through it with such lightning rapidity that the butler doubted whether she had seen him come in. Half an hour later, Clovis was driving her and her hastily packed luggage to the station. "Mother will be awfully vexed when she comes back from her ride and finds you have gone," he observed to the departing guest. "But I'll make up some story about an urgent wire having called you away. It wouldn't do to alarm her unnecessarily about Sturridge." Jane sniffed slightly at Clovis's idea of unnecessary alarm, and was almost rude to the young man who came round with thoughtful inquiries as to luncheon baskets. The miracle lost some of its usefulness from the fact that Dora wrote the same day, postponing the date of her visit, but at any rate, Clovis holds the record as the only human being who ever hustled Jane Martlett out of the timetable of her migrations. Notice the use of unexpected words, signifying the fine writing or the one technique of Bell Letters. So he says migration instead of saying departures, and the average departures, he says timetable of her migrations. He uses coaxes for getting spots out. Instead of saying removing rust spots, he coaxes them out. Things that a writer would notice, or someone studying literature. So that was the hen. Next up is the open window. "My aunt will be down presently," Mr. Nuttall, N-U-T-T-E-L, said, a very self-possessed young lady of 15. "In the meantime, you must try and put up with me." Frampton Nuttall endeavored to say the correct something which should duly flatter the niece of the moment, without unduly discounting the aunt that was to come. Privately, he doubted more than ever whether these formal visits on a succession of total strangers would do much toward helping the nerve cure for which he was supposed to be undergoing, or which he was supposed to be undergoing, a nerve cure. "I know how it will be," his sister had said when he was preparing to migrate again to this rural retreat. "You will bury yourself down there and not speak to a living soul, and your nerves will be worse than ever from moping. I shall just give you letters of introduction to all the people I know there. Some of them, as far as I can remember, were quite nice." Frampton wondered whether Mrs. Sappleton, the lady to whom he was presenting one of the letters of introduction, came into the nice division. "Do you know many of the people around here?" asked the niece, when she judged that they had sufficient silent communion. "Hardly a soul," said Frampton. "My sister was staying here at the rectory, you know, some 4 years ago, and she gave me letters of introduction to some of the people here." He made the last statement in a tone of distinct regret. "Then you know practically nothing about my aunt," pursued the self-possessed young lady. "Only your name and address," admitted the caller. He was wondering whether Mrs. Sappleton was in the married or widowed state. An undefinable something about the room seemed to suggest masculine habitation. Her great tragedy happened just 3 years ago, said the child. That would be since your sister's time. Her tragedy? Asked Frampton. Somehow in this restful country spot, tragedy seemed out of place. You may wonder why we keep that window wide open on an October afternoon, said the niece, indicating a large French window that opened onto a lawn. It is quite warm for this time of year, Frampton, but has that window got anything to do with the tragedy? Out through that window, 3 years ago to a day, her husband and her two young brothers went off for their day's shooting. They never came back. In crossing the moor to their favorite snipe shooting ground, they were all three engulfed in a treacherous piece of bog. It had been that dreadful wet summer, you know, and places that were safe in other years gave way suddenly without warning. Their bodies were never recovered. That was the dreadful part of it. Here the child's voice lost its self-possessed note and became falteringly human. Poor aunt always thinks that they will come back someday, they and the little brown spaniel that was lost with them, and walk in at that window just as they used to do. That is why the window is kept open every evening till it is quite dusk. Poor dear aunt, she has often told me how they went out, her husband with his white waterproof coat over his arm, and Ronnie, her youngest brother, singing, "Birdie, why do you bound?" as he always did to tease her, because she said it got on her nerves. Do you know, sometimes on still, quiet evenings like this, I almost get a creepy feeling that they will all walk in through that window. She broke off with a little shudder. It was a relief to Frampton when the aunt bustled into the room with a whirl of apologies for being late in making her appearance. I hope Vera has been amusing to you, she said. She has been very interesting, said Frampton. I hope you don't mind the open window, said Mrs. Sappleton briskly. My husband and brothers will be home directly from the shooting, and they always come in this way. They've been out for snipe in the marshes today, so they'll make a fine mess over my poor carpets. So like you menfolk, isn't it? And are you starting to guess that maybe this girl is a female Clovis? She rattled on cheerfully about the shooting and the scarcity of birds and the prospects for duck in the winter. To Frampton, it was all purely horrible. He made a desperate but only partially successful effort to turn the talk to a less ghastly topic. He was conscious that his hostess was giving him only a fraction of her attention, a fragment of her attention, and her eyes were constantly straying past him to the open window and the lawn beyond. It was certainly an unfortunate coincidence that he should have paid his visit on this tragic anniversary. The doctors agree in ordering me complete rest, an absence of mental excitement, an avoidance of anything in the nature of violent physical exercise, announced Frampton, who labored under the tolerably widespread delusion that total strangers and chance acquaintances are hungry for the least detail of one's ailments and infirmities, their cause and cure. On the matter of diet, they are not so much in agreement, he continued. No, said Mrs. Sappleton, in a voice which only replaced a yawn at the last moment. Then she suddenly brightened into alert attention, but not to what Frampton was saying. Here they are at last, she cried, just in time for tea. Don't they look as if they were muddy up to the eyes? Frampton shivered slightly and turned toward the niece with a look intended to convey sympathetic comprehension. The child was staring out through the open window with dazed horror in her eyes. In a chill shock of nameless fear, Frampton swung round in his seat and looked in the same direction. In the deepening twilight, three figures were walking across the lawn towards the window. They all carried guns under their arms, and one of them was additionally burdened with a white coat hung over his shoulders. A tired brown spaniel kept close at their heels. Noiselessly, they neared the house, and then a hoarse young voice chanted out of the dusk, I said, Birdie, why do you bound? Frampton grabbed wildly at his stick and hat. The hall door and the gravel drive and the front gate were dimly noted stages in his headlong retreat. A cyclist coming along the road had to run into the hedge to avoid imminent collision. Here we are, my dear, said the bearer of the white Macintosh, coming in through the window. Fairly muddy, but most of it's dry. Who was that who bolted out as we came up? A most extraordinary man, a Mr. Nuttall, said Mrs. Sappleton. Could only talk about his illnesses, and dashed off without a word of goodbye or apology when you arrived. One would have think he had seen a ghost. I expect it was the spaniel, said the niece calmly. He told me he had a horror of dogs. He was once hunted into a cemetery somewhere on the banks of the Ganges by a pack of pariah dogs and had to spend the night in a newly dug grave with a creature snarling and grinning and foaming just above him, enough to make anyone lose their nerve. Romance at short notice was her specialty. Third story is The Treasure Ship. The great galleon lay in semi-retirement under the sandweed and water of the northern bay where the fortune of war and weather had long ago ensconced it. 3 1/4 centuries had passed since the day when it had taken on the high seas as an important unit of a fighting squadron, precisely which squadron the learned were not agreed. The galleon had brought nothing into the world, but it had, according to tradition and report, taken much out of it. But how much? There again the learned were in disagreement. Some were as generous in their estimate as an income tax assessor. Others applied a species of higher criticism to the submerged treasure chests and debased their contents to the currency of goblin gold. Of the former school was Lulu, Duchess of Dulverton. The Duchess was not only a believer in the existence of a sunken treasure of alluring proportions, she also believed that she knew of a method by which the said treasure might be precisely located and cheaply disembedded. An aunt on the mother's side of the family had been a maid of honor at the court of Monaco and had taken a respectful interest in the deep sea researches in which the throne of that country, impatient perhaps of its terrestrial restrictions, was wont to immerse itself. It was through the instrumentality of this relative that the Duchess learned of an invention perfected and very nearly patented by a Monegascan savant, by means of which the home life of the Mediterranean sardine might be studied at a depth of many fathoms in a cold white light of more than ballroom brilliancy. Implicated in this invention, and in the Duchess's eyes the most attractive part of it, was an electric suction dredge, specially designed for dragging to the surface such objects of interest and value as might be found in the more accessible levels of the ocean bed. The rights of the invention were to be acquired for a matter of 1,800 francs, and the apparatus for a few thousand more. The Duchess of Dulverton was rich, as the world counted wealth. She nursed the hope of being one day rich in her own computation. Companies had been formed, and efforts had been made again and again during the course of 3 centuries to probe for the alleged treasures of the interesting galleon. With the aid of this invention, she considered that she might go to work on the wreck privately and independently. After all, one of her ancestors on her mother's side was descended from Medina Sidonia, so she was of the opinion that she had as much right to the treasure as anyone. She acquired the invention and bought the apparatus. You know, getting a dredge to get the dark ocean out of the way with the light, and a dredge and bring it up to the top. Among other family ties and encumbrances, Lulu possessed a nephew, Vasco Honiton, a young gentleman who was blessed with a small income and a large circle of relatives and lived impartially and precariously on both. The name Vasco had been given him, possibly in the hope that he might live up to its adventurous tradition, Vasco da Gama. But he limited himself strictly to the home industry of adventurer, preferring to exploit the assured rather than to explore the unknown. Lulu's intercourse with him had been restricted of recent years to the negative processes of being out of town when he called on her and short of money when he wrote to her. Now, however, she bethought herself of his eminent suitability for the direction of a treasure-seeking experiment. If anyone could extract gold from an uncompromising or unpromising situation, it would certainly be Vasco, of course, under the necessary safeguards in the way of supervision. Where money was in question, Vasco's conscience was liable to fits of obstinate silence. Somewhere on the west coast of Ireland, the Dulverton property included a few acres of shingle, rock, and heather, too barren to support even an agrarian outrage, but embracing a small and fairly deep bay where the lobster yield was good in most seasons. There was a bleak little house on the property, and for those who liked lobsters and solitude, and were able to accept an Irish cook's idea as to what might be perpetrated in the name of mayonnaise, Innisgluther was a tolerable exile during the summer months. Name of the place, Innisgluther. Lulu seldom went there herself, but she lent the house lavishly to friends and relations. She put it now at Vasco's disposal. "It will be the very place to practice an experiment with the salvage apparatus," she said. "The bay is quite deep in places, and you'll be able to test everything thoroughly before starting on the treasure hunt." In less than 3 weeks, Vasco turned up in town to report progress. "The apparatus works beautifully," he informed his aunt. "The deeper one got, the clearer everything grew. We found something in the way of a sunken wreck to operate on, too." "A wreck in Innisgluther Bay?" exclaimed Lulu. "A submerged motorboat, the Sub Rosa," said Vasco. That's kind of a joke. Sub Rosa, kind of under your breath. Akin to underwater. No, really, said Lulu. "Poor Billy Yutley's boat. I remember it went down somewhere off the coast some 3 years ago. His body was washed ashore at the point. People said at the time that the boat was capsized intentionally. A case of suicide, you know. People always say that sort of thing when anything tragic happens." "Well, in this case, they were right," said Vasco. "What do you mean?" said the Duchess, hurriedly. "What makes you think so?" "I know," said Vasco, simply. "No? How can you know? How can anyone know? What makes you think the thing happened 3 years ago?" "In a locker of the Sub Rosa, I found a watertight strong box. It contained papers." Vasco paused with dramatic effect and searched for a moment in the inner breast pocket of his coat. He drew out a folded slip of paper. The Duchess snatched at it in almost indecent haste and moved appreciably nearer the fireplace. "Was this in the Sub Rosa's strong box?" she asked. "Oh, no," said Vasco carelessly. "That is a list of the well-known people who would be involved in a very disagreeable scandal if the Sub Rosa's papers were made public. I put you at the head of it. Otherwise, it follows alphabetical order." The Duchess gazed helplessly at the string of names, which seemed for a moment to include nearly everyone she knew. As a matter of fact, her own name at the head of the list exercised an almost paralyzing effect on her thinking faculties. "Of course you have destroyed the papers," she asked, when she had somewhat recovered herself. She was conscious that she made the remark with an entire lack of conviction. Vasco shook his head. Remember, he's used to wheedling money out of people. "But you should have," said Lulu angrily, "if, as you say, they are highly compromising." "Oh, they are, I assure you of that," interposed the young man. "Then you should put them out of the harm's way at once. Supposing anything should leak out, think of all these poor, unfortunate people who would be involved in the disclosures." And Lulu tapped the list with an agitated gesture. "Unfortunate, perhaps, but not poor," corrected Vasco. "If you read the list carefully, you'll notice that I haven't troubled to include anyone whose financial standing isn't above question." Lulu glared at her nephew for some moments in silence. Then she asked hoarsely, "What are you going to do?" "Nothing, for the remainder of my life," he answered meaningly. "A little hunting, perhaps," he continued, "and I shall have a villa at Florence. The Villa Sub Rosa would sound rather quaint and picturesque, don't you think? And quite a lot of people would be able to attach a meaning to the name. And I suppose I must have a hobby. I shall probably collect Rayburns." Lulu's relative, who lived at the court of Monaco, got quite a snappish answer when she wrote recommending some further invention in the realm of marine research. So not the first story that revolved around blackmail and was settled in the exact same way. Now, let's see. We have, I think, one more to go, the cobweb. The farmhouse kitchen probably stood where it did as a matter of accident or haphazard choice, yet its situation might have been planned by a master strategist in farmhouse architecture. Daisy and poultry yard and herb garden and all the busy places of the farm seemed to lead by easy access into its wide flagged haven where there was room for everything and where muddy boots left traces that were easily swept away. And yet, for all that, it stood so well in the center of human bustle, its long latticed window with the wide open window seat, the wide window seat built into an embrasure beyond the huge fireplace, looked out on a wild spreading view of hill and heather and wooded combe, C-O-M-B-E. The window nook made almost a little room in itself, quite the pleasantest room in the farm as far as situation and capabilities went. Young Mrs. Ladbruk, L-A-D-B-R-U-K, whose husband had just come into the farm by way of inheritance, cast covetous eyes on this smug corner, and her fingers itched to make it bright and cozy with chintz curtains and bowls of flowers and a shelf or two of old china. The musty farm parlor, looking out to a prim, cheerless garden, imprisoned within high, blank walls, was not a room that lent itself readily either to comfort or decoration. "When we are more settled, I shall work wonders in the way of making the kitchen habitable," said the young woman to her occasional visitors. There was an unspoken wish in those words, a wish which was confirmed as well as unspoken. Emma Ladbruk was the mistress of the farm. Jointly with her husband, she might have had her say. She might have her say, and to a certain extent her way, in ordering its affairs, but she was not mistress of the kitchen. On one of the shelves of an old dresser, in company with the chipped sauce boats, pewter jugs, cheese graters, and paid bills, rested a worn and ragged Bible, on whose front page was the record, in faded ink, of a baptism dated 94 years ago. Martha Crail was the name written on that yellow page. The yellow, wrinkled old dame who hobbled and muttered about the kitchen, looking like a dead autumn leaf, which the winter wind still pushed hither and thither, had once been Martha Crail. For 70-odd years, she had been Martha Mountjoy. For longer than anyone could remember, she had pattered to and fro between oven and washhouse and dairy, and out to chicken run and garden, grumbling and muttering and scolding, but working unceasingly. Emma Ladbruk, of whose coming she took as little notice as she would of a bee wandering in at a window on a summer's day, used at first to watch her with a kind of frightened curiosity. She was so old and so much a part of the place, it was difficult to think of her exactly as a living thing. Old Shep, the white-nozzled, stiff-limbed collie, waiting for his time to die, seemed almost more human than the withered, dried-up old woman. He had been a riotous, roistering puppy, mad with the joy of life, when she was already a tottering, hobbling dame. Now he was just a blind, breathing carcass, nothing more, and she still worked with frail energy, still swept and baked and washed, fetched and carried. If there were something in these wise dogs that did not perish utterly with death, Emma used to think to herself, what generations of ghost dogs there must be out in those hills that Martha had reared and fed and tended and spoken a last goodbye word to in that old kitchen. This story is the cobweb. And what memories she must have of human generations that had passed away in her time. It was difficult for anyone, let alone a stranger like Emma, to get her to talk of the days that had been. Her shrill, quavering speech was of doors that had been left unfastened, pails that had got mislaid, calves whose feeding time was overdue, and the various little faults and lapses that checker a farmhouse routine. Now and again, when election time came round, she would unstore her recollections of the old names round which the fight had waged in the days gone by. There had been a Palmerston. That had been a name down Tiverton way. Tiverton was not a far journey as the crow flies, but to Martha it was almost a foreign country. Later there had been Northcotes and Acklands, and many other newer names that she had forgotten. The names changed, but it was always Liberals and Tories, Yellows and Blues, and they always quarreled and shouted as to who was right and who was wrong. The one they quarreled about most was a fine old gentleman with an angry face. She had seen his picture on the walls. She had seen it on the floor, too, with a rotten apple squashed over it, for the farm had changed its position from time to time. Martha had never been on the one side of or the other. None of they had ever done the farm a good stroke of good. Such was her sweeping verdict, given with all a peasant's distrust of the outside world. When the half-fright and curiosity somewhat faded away, Emma Ladbruk was uncomfortably conscious of another feeling toward the old woman. She was a quaint old tradition, lingering about the place. She was part and parcel of the farm itself. She was something at once pathetic and picturesque, but she was dreadfully in the way. Emma had come to the farm full of plans for little reforms and improvements, in part the result of training in the newest ways and methods, in part the outcome of her own ideas and fancies. Reforms in the kitchen region, if those deaf ears could have been induced to even give them a hearing, would have met with short shrift and scornful rejection, and the kitchen region spread over the zone of dairy and market business and half the work of the household. Emma, with the latest science of dead poultry dressing at her fingertips, sat by, an unheeded watcher, while old Martha trussed the chickens for the market stall as she had trussed them for nearly 40 years, all leg and no breast. And the 100 hints anent effective cleaning and labor lightening and all the things that make for wholesomeness, which the young woman was ready to impart or put into action, dropped away into nothingness before that wan, muttering, unheeding presence. Above all, the coveted window corner, that was to be a dainty, cheerful oasis in the gaunt old kitchen, stood now choked and lumbered with a litter of odds and ends that Emma, for all her nominal authority, authority in name only, would not have dared to, or cared to, displace. Over them seemed to be spun the protection of something that was like a human cobweb. Decidedly, Martha was in the way. It would have been an unworthy meanness to have wished to see the span of that brave old life shortened by a few paltry months, but as the days sped by, Emma was conscious that the wish was there, disowned though it might be, lurking at the back of her mind. She wants the old woman to die and get out of the way. She felt the meanness of the wish come over her with a qualm of self-reproach one day when she came into the kitchen and found an unaccustomed state of things in that usually busy quarter. Old Martha was not working. A basket of corn was on the floor by her side, and out in the yard, poultry were beginning to clamor a protest of overdue feeding time. But Martha sat huddled in a shrunken bench on the window seat, looking out with her dim old eyes as though she saw something stranger than the autumn landscape. "Is anything the matter, Martha?" asked the young woman. "'Tis death a-comin'," answered the old quavering voice. "I knew 'twere coming, I knew it. 'Twarn't for nothing that old Shep's been howling all morning, and last night I heard the screech owl give the death cry, and there was something white as run across the yard yesterday. 'Twarn't a cat nor a stoat. It's like a ermine or weasel. 'Twere something. The fowls knew 'twere something. They all drew off to one side. Aye, there's been warnings. I knew it were coming." The young woman's eyes clouded with pity. The old thing sitting there so white and shrunken had once been a merry, noisy child, playing about in lanes and haylofts and farm garrets, and that had been 80-odd years ago, and now she was just a frail old body, cowering under the approaching chill of the death that was coming to at last to take her. It was not probable that much could be done for her, but Emma hastened away to get assistance and counsel. Her husband, she knew, was down at a tree felling some little distance off, but she might find some other intelligent soul who knew the old woman better than she did. The farm, she soon found out, had that faculty common to farmyards of swallowing up and losing its human population. The poultry followed her in interested fashion, and swine grunted interrogations at her from behind the bars of their sties, but barnyard and rickyard, orchard and stables and dairy, gave no reward to her search. Then, as she retraced her steps toward the kitchen, she came suddenly on her cousin, young Mr. Jim, as everyone called him, who divided his time between amateur horse-stealing, rabbit-shooting, and flirting with the farm maids. "I'm afraid old Martha is dying," said Emma. Jim was not the sort of person to whom one had to break news gently. "Nonsense," he said. "Martha means to live to 100. She told me so, and she'll do it." "She may actually be dying at this moment, or it may just be the beginning of the breakup," persisted Emma, with a feeling of contempt for the slowness and dullness of the young man. A grin spread over his good-natured features. "It don't look like it," he said, nodding towards the yard. Emma turned to catch the meaning of his remark. Old Martha stood in the middle of a mob of poultry, scattering handfuls of grain about her. The turkey cock, with the bronze sheen of his feathers and the purple red of his wattles, the game cock with the glowing metallic luster of his eastern plumage, the hens with their ochres and buffs and umbers and their scarlet combs, and the drakes with their bottle green heads made a medley of rich color, in the center of which the old woman looked like a withered stalk standing amid the riotous growth of gaily hued flowers. But she threw the grain deftly amid the wilderness of beaks, and her quavering voice carried as far as the two people who were watching her. She was still harping on the theme of death coming to the farm. I knew it were coming. There's been signs and warnings. "Who's dead then, old mother?" called the young man. "'Tis young Mr. Ladbrook," she shrilled back. "They've just a-carried his body in, run out of the way of a tree that was coming down, and ran himself onto an iron post. Dead when they picked him up. I knew it were coming." She turned to fling a handful of barley at a belated group of guinea fowl that came racing toward her. The farm was a family property, and passed to the rabbit-shooting cousin as the next of kin. Emma Ladbrook drifted out of its history, as a bee that had wandered in at an open window might flit its way out again. On a cold gray morning, she stood waiting with her boxes, already stowed in the farm cart, till the last of the market produce should be ready, for the train she was to catch was of less importance than the chickens and butter and eggs that were to be offered for sale. From where she stood, she could see an angle of the long latticed window that was to have been cozy with curtains and gay with bowls of flowers. Into her mind came the thought that, for months, perhaps for years, long after she had been utterly forgotten, a white, unheeding face would be seen peering out through the latticed panes, and a weak, muttering voice would be heard quavering up and down those flagged passages. She made her way to a narrow, barred casement that opened into the farm larder. Old Martha was standing at a table trussing a pair of chickens for the market stall, as she had trussed them for nearly 40 years. I'll let you make of that what you will. Past more powerful than it seems? Traditions more powerful? Or cobwebs are not so easily brushed away? Anyway, that will do for our stories today. I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Hector Human Row, The Complete Stories of Saki. And as I've said, everything you can find that we record at vnnforum.com. So thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again for more from Saki real soon.